Welcome to the Appen & Appen Podcast, episode 63, the podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry. In today's show, we'll be talking about the podcast we've been listening to.
We did a deep dive on Ansible.
And Jerry talks about FOSDEM and Config Management Camp. Jerry was recently at two amazing conferences, neither of which I've been to, but both sound phenomenal. So, Jerry, I understand you were at FOSDEM and Config Management Camp.
That's right,
yeah. What can you tell us about them?
Well, they're both in Belgium for a start, so you get to drink some nice Belgian beer when you're over there. But more than that, you get to see a lot of interesting tech talks in a weirdly academic setting. FOSDEM is held at the, I think it's called the Université Libre Bruxelles, so Brussels Free University. And it's been going on for many years. I haven't done my proper research. I don't know how many years, but it's been going for a while. And it's just free and open source event with loads and loads of talks. Just looking at the website here, there's five different buildings sort of spread around the campus where the talks take place. Not just talks, but also sort of exhibition stands and so on, with many different open source companies represented there. So everyone from VLC I saw there, the famous media player, sort of Grafana, Prometheus. I'm just going by the tables I actually stopped at. And yeah, it's basically a question of looking at the schedule, finding out what talks you want to go to, and making a beeline for those talks at the time they're supposed to be happening, and hoping that you can actually get into the room, because it's very busy. There's a lot of people there coming from, I guess, from all over Europe, or even actually from America as well. It's that kind of it's got that kind of reach. So yeah, quite an experience, really.
So if I was an open source developer, or I was interested in kind of open source projects, why would I want to go to FOSDEM?
Well, you can just hear talks, and not just that, you hear talks, you can talk to people going, you know, either going to the talks or people giving the talks, just about things like the state of the art, really, in technologies that you might be using, bits of software you might be using, that are just sort of highlighted when you're there. So you've got different tracks going on in different rooms, basically. So to give you an idea of that, I'll put this in the show notes, but there's a community track, for instance, a history track, miscellaneous, who knows what that means, security and encryption, space, interestingly, Python, global diversity. So there's kind of something for everyone, really. And then there's developer rooms. So, I mean, just a selection of the different developer rooms. You've got config management, obviously something near and dear to me. Graphics, HPC, big data, data science, PostgreSQL, MySQL and friends, monitoring and cloud. So these are all different rooms that will have specific talks that cover those subjects. So yeah, I mean, something for everyone, really. I mean, everyone should make it there at least once in their sort of IT career, I suppose, or even just in their life, if they're into that sort of thing.
So my knowledge of FOSDEM pretty much in the past has been from kind of watching and listening other people talking about the event.
Mm.
So it's usually kind of like in the first couple of weeks of the year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that right?
This one was, so this was February. Like I said, we were going to talk about it on the last podcast, but we didn't have time. It's the 3rd and 4th of February. So it's usually at the beginning, sort of beginning or middle of February, I think.
Right. Okay. And it's in an academic building.
Yeah. several academic buildings.
Several academic buildings. So typically, do you tend to like, do people tend to follow a single track, or do they kind of pre-record in advance where they're going to go to and then kind of spend a few days kind of crossing between buildings?
It's a mixture, really. I mean, the first time I went this year, I did the latter. So basically seeing talks that I like the look of and then crossing over to the campus to those buildings. I mean, sometimes it was the building next door, but sometimes it was the other side of the campus. And then you get there, find the room and hope it's not full. And then you listen to the talk or watch the talk.
Let's talk about favourites and least favourites. What was your favourite part of the event?
I think a lot of people say this. It's the socialising. Sort of in the evening after all the talks have finished, people tend to go into Brussels and just meet up with people, with other people that they're there with, or they've met during the day, or that sort of thing. For me, I mean, the actual conference, my favourite bit was the monitoring and cloud room, developer room, because that's the stuff that I'm interested in. So, quite a few interesting talks there.
You've mentioned a couple of things that kind of might put people off, like going to a room and it finding it being full, or having to cross like a campus to get between talks that you want to get to. Are those pretty much the worst things about being there? Or
it gets really busy. So if you're someone that can't deal well with crowds, then it might not be for you. But all the talks are actually streamed.
Oh, right, okay.
So you don't actually have to go to the conference at all. I think the talks are streamed on the website. And, you know, it being an sort of IT techie conference, that's quite well handled. You could just sit in a cafe nearby and if the talk's oversubscribed, or even just outside the room, if you can't make it in there and still get to see the talk. So that's pretty good.
What about the language barrier at any talk?
It's mostly English. I mean, all the talks, as far as I know, are given in English because it's just kind of the lingua franca, as they say. Yeah, I mean, that's fine. And often, I don't know, I mean, it's just one of those things, isn't it? You go abroad and you start speaking English. And once you start speaking English, people start talking to you in English. And even to each other in English, even if this is not their first language. We are lucky, we are blessed that way.
And is there lots of stands as well you can go and kind of have a look at?
There's a few, there's not many. There was one building that I didn't make it too much. There was like a maker building, or maker, you know, had more talks there about home automation and maker stuff. And I didn't make it to those as much, partly because the building was a bit more out of the way and partly because there's so much other stuff going on that I was more interested in, personally. Not that that stuff's not interesting, but it just
wasn't what you really were there for.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's mostly FOSDEM. Was there any specific talk that you went to that you think that the listeners of this podcast should make an effort to reach out to and listen to?
There was one quite interesting one, which if anyone is using GPG and is finding it a bit hard to get their head round, there's a thing called Easy GNU PG. I'll put a link in the show notes. And it's basically a set of scripts which tries to simplify GPG. So, you know, just a brief overview of GPG. It's a way of doing public-private key crypto, a bit like SSH keys. But a bit more complicated. It looked like a really interesting way of simplifying all that and allowing people to maybe get into it a bit more easily. Personally, I haven't tried it because I got my head around the GPG command and been using that. That was the one that was sort of struck me as most interesting and something that I probably need to look at.
So that's largely sort of FOSDEM covered off. So obviously you left FOSDEM and then, as I recall, it was either kind of the next couple of days or it might have been a week or so later, you were back there for Config Management Camp.
Config Management Camp is in a city or town nearby called Ghent, which is about, I suppose, 20 or 30 kilometres from Brussels. And it's timed to take place directly after FOSDEM. So FOSDEM takes place on Saturday and Sunday. And then conflict management camp was Monday and Tuesday. And there's some sort of, well, they call them fringe events on the Wednesday, but they're more like kind of deep dives into a specific thing. Conflict management camp, pretty much what it said on the tin. It was another conference where in another university where most of the sort of big config management bits of software were represented. Weirdly, Ansible had quite a small presence there, I suppose. So the talks on the first day took place in this sort of big lecture theatre. The first one was by Mark Burgess. Now, he is the author of CF Engine, which is like the granddaddy of config management software. It was written quite a while ago now, getting on for a decade maybe. So it predates anything, you know, Puppet or Chef or any of those things. And then immediately after that, you had a talk by Luke Canice. Now, he's the main architect, founder of Puppet Labs. So that was interesting. And then immediately after that, you had Adam Jacob, who is to Chef as Luke Canice is to Puppet. So the first morning, you've got Mark Burgess, Luke Canice, and Adam Jacob, who are three who have basically invented the most, possibly the three of the most influential bits of config management software, just talking about how it's working and how what their view on it is. So that was really interesting. And then, there was a load of talks after that that I didn't go to. There's talks in other rooms about certain aspects of all these different bits of software. So, yeah, so that was really interesting.
So you mentioned before that FOSDEM had a sort of configuration management track to it.
Yeah.
Was there much in the way of overlap between Config Management Camp and the Config Management track at FOSDEM?
There was actually a few people that were talking at FOSDEM who did talks at Config Management Camp. So one of those was Kubernetes security best practices by I think someone that worked at Google, Ian Lewis, and he did the talk both at FOSDEM on the Sunday at 2:10. I'll just look that up, and he did the same talk at Config Management Camp. So there were a few like that. There were a couple. But obviously I only went to one of them in each case. I didn't actually go to the config management room too much at FOSDEM because I was trying to get a more flavor of if there was a config management talk and it looked like it was something that I knew about, I would go to a different talk that was scheduled at the same time. Because also I knew I was going to config management camp afterwards. So I'd get all the config management stuff that I might need there.
So if you had already gone to FOSDEM, do you think it's worth extending the trip to go to config management camp if you're in the sort of role that would be using infrastructure as code or sort of that kind of architecture?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think so. It's worth going to FOSDEM just to get a, because it's a much broader range of things that are discussed or presented there. So it's worth going to FOSDEM just for that. I mean, just like I just said, I found myself avoiding the config management talks because I knew that I would be going to a conference that was specifically tailored to that in a couple of days' time.
Did you say there's also like it's like a training thing as well? You could go like a boot camp kind of thing. Did you say
there was a few? I mean, Kubernetes was another. It's not really config management software from the sort of the way I see it, but they were represented at config management camp. So there was a, you know, there was a sort of introduction to Kubernetes. This happened on the Wednesday. So config management camp, as I said, takes place on Monday and Tuesday, and then on the Wednesday. There's these, they're almost like classroom sessions or what would they be called? I suppose seminars maybe if you're at university, where you just sit in a classroom and someone teaches you about some either product or Yeah, I mean, it's usually it's product based. So I went to the Systig one, and it was Systig is a kind of a system. It works a bit like TCP dump for system calls. So, and what you can use it for is to look into containers and find out what's going on inside a container. Because if you have a container and you haven't got, you know, you might not even have bash in this container. So how are you going to get in and see what it's doing? Well, you can sort of talk to the kernel of the host system that's running the container, and then sort of get to dig down and find out what's going on at system level or kernel level. And you can sort of, you have all these filters and things that you can really sort of dig down into what's going on. So it was like they had these scenarios, and then they'd go through the commands and so on to do that. So that's pretty interesting.
Going back to kind of the way we've talked about FOSDEM and kind of having a best thing about FOSDEM and a worst thing about FOSDEM, what do you think the best thing about about Config Management Camp was for you?
I think being around, well, seeing all those sort of big names was quite good, and what their opinions were about the whole sort of landscape. That was pretty good. That was pretty interesting. It's a shame that Ansible wasn't better represented, I think. And I suppose the worst thing was, I don't know. I don't know if there was a downside.
Excellent. Even better. Fair enough.
Because it was all interesting, and there was nothing that really sort of got my goat when I was there.
Was there anyone you met who you wanted to meet, like a star or something in the open source world you got to speak to?
Not really, but I was quite happy. I mean, I wasn't, I didn't know who Mark Burgess was. I knew of CF Engine, but he did have some interesting views on things, and I guess he's kind of looked up to as a kind of bit of a guru, really, when it comes to the whole thing. Actually, there was a good talk by there's a company in this country called Bashton. I don't know if you heard of them, but their sort of head guy, I guess the guy that started it, is called Sam Bashton, and he did a talk about we called it immutable infrastructure in the past here. The idea of just packaging an image and then deploying that image, and the image, you know that the image is good because it's all tested and so on. He's always done good talks. I saw a talk of his about 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago now, actually. And this one was about, they started calling it disposable infrastructure, which is interesting. Anyway, his talk was, it's probably not what you want. And he was talking about having immutable or disposable infrastructure up to a certain point, and then allowing, you know, being a bit more flexible on top of that. So yeah, that was an interesting talk.
Config Management Camp is a smaller event than FOSDEM.
Yeah, a lot smaller. Yeah, it's still got multiple tracks, but each of those tracks is in like effectively a classroom, so you can tell, you know, that it's a classroom with, you know, a room that could fit probably at most about 40 or so people in it. Whereas FOSDEM is, each of the, even the smaller rooms are kind of lecture theatre sort of size, so probably you can fit in 2 or 3 times as many people. And often those are full. So that gives you an idea. And, you know, getting into these rooms is sometimes a, you know, it's not exactly elbowing each other out of the way, but it's not far off.
So it sounds like it was a good event.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if that's your bag, Config Management, or then I'd say go to Config Management Camp, and definitely make a sort of pilgrimage to FOSDEM at least once in your IT life. and you know, if you are of that mind, then you probably know people that have been. So why not go with them next year?
Talking of people that are going there, is there kind of like a way of finding people that are at the event, or is it just all about kind of, you know, putting the word out there that you're going to it on social media?
Yeah, I think that would be the key. Yeah, I hadn't actually expected to go to it because it was coinciding with the end of a contract, and my last contract, and the start of another one. So I thought I might have to pass it up, but in... just timing wise it worked out that that I wasn't going, I wasn't going to be starting anything, so I was able to go to Fosden. And I ended up, a friend of mine was going, and so we met up there. We actually got an Airbnb for the config management camp in Ghent together, so that's quite fun. So, yeah, I'd say make the most of it. Treat it as kind of a mini break, maybe. And,
just without the family. Excellent.
Yeah, well, take your family as well, if they're into it as well. But Fosden is busy, that's the only thing. So if you're taking kids, it can get busy, and they'd have to be really into it. Maybe they could do something else. Brussels, there's a lot going on in Brussels.
So that sounds it's definitely something that's on my personal bucket list. Just haven't got around to it yet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this friend of mine was going last year, and he said, "Oh, do you want to come?" And I just couldn't make it last year. But this year, the stars aligned, and I was able to go.
And do you think it's something you'd do more frequently? Would you do it again in the future?
I'd like to do it next year. So if anyone wants to meet up there, maybe we could have an admin fringe event or something. I don't know. Record a podcast there.
Yeah, sounds really interesting. Moving on. So before I was, in the last episode, I was talking about that I was going to be setting up a new server to host some websites on, because I'm trying to migrate off my free BSD box, and I've kind of heard about what Joe's been talking about, Ansible, so I've been playing with that quite a lot, I think the best way you can kind of learn things is by having something to do. So I've been using Ansible to deploy my latest Ubuntu Nginx stack. So I have basically figured out what I needed to know from you guys, but I think it'd be nice if you kind of explain how it all kind of works, and at the end I can tell you what I've done so far to see if I think I've done it the right way or not.
I mean, first of all, there probably is no right way or wrong way, but there are sort of certain best practices that I've done quite enough talking, so John, I'll let you take this one.
Okay, obviously we do a little bit of prep before we go into the show, and so I kind of drew up a list of kind of things that I wanted to talk about my how I see Ansible. So first of all, Ansible is a Python-based scripting tool that is predominantly used for post-provisioning servers. So if you imagine that you've stood 10 machines up and you want to apply the same config to those 10 machines, you can do that quite easily with Ansible. And you can also define different roles for those 10 machines. So say you've got 3 machines doing database servicing, and 3 machines doing logic processing, and 3 machines doing front-end processing, and a load balancer that sits between them all. You know, you can do all of that with Ansible as well. So you can define like a common role that gets applied to them all, and have specific things that are installed on each of the machines. There are a few alternatives. So obviously we've mentioned Ansible, which is the one that Jerry and I and now Al use predominantly. But there are also tools like Puppet and Chef. So Chef, I think, came first. Well, Config, I think it was Config Engine that Jerry mentioned earlier, came first, like historically much, much earlier. But then there was Chef, which is a Ruby-based system, and Puppet, which has, although it's, I believe that is Python.
It's Ruby.
It is Ruby as well, yeah, sorry. So yeah, so Puppet and Chef are both Ruby, and they both have very distinctive ways of looking at things. And the main thing that they have in common is that they have like a control machine that controls everything else. But they also have agents that run on those machines. So all the time that you are using Puppet or Chef, or Salt as well, which is the other one that I was going to mention, you have an agent that lives on those machines, and they're calling back regularly to the control machine to say, is there anything new to apply to my machine? Which, particularly in sort of a low overhead world, makes it less friendly, because it means you're having to have an extra service that's running on those boxes to call home and ask for updates.
I think that's the way they were designed in the first place, but both of those systems have ways of running without a server.
Absolutely.
I think originally they might have been designed to have a master and clients which configure themselves depending on what you've put on the master, basically.
Yes, absolutely. But so certainly when you go through any of the documentation about Puppet and Chef and Salt, they all start with stand up your control machine, stand up your slave machine or minion or whatever it, whatever the terminology is in the documentation you're following through, and then we'll push the config from the master to the slaves. You don't tend to see the documentation start, you know, let's apply config to ourselves, which is what you tend to get with Ansible. Hmm. Ansible is very much starts with, you know, run this module against yourself to see how you, what data you get back, and then do this and do that. So I have used Puppet in the past. I've never used Chef. I've recently been encouraged to look at Salt, but my initial pass of Salt led me to believe that it wasn't fit for the purposes that I was looking at it for. So, Jerry, as you've done a lot more of the config management than I have, what have you used or haven't you used?
I've used Puppet. I started off with Puppet and then did quite a lot of stuff with that at a company I used to work for. Also did my first big, you know, the thing that almost got me fired with it, which was deleting a shed load of data, without meaning to. So that just, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, or whatever the saying is. And I've used Ansible. Funnily enough, I had heard on Floss Weekly, which is where I tended to hear it in those days about open source projects. About Salt, and I was going to look at it, and then but someone else told me about Ansible, and I decided to look at that, and I sort of haven't looked back since then, really. So so I haven't managed to look at Salt, but I was about to. I've done a bit of Chef, in that I was converting the Chef code to Ansible code at somewhere that I was working, so it was just getting an idea of what it was up to, and then writing Ansible code to do that instead, and that's pretty much it. Yeah,
Al, have you used any of these aside from Ansible?
Nope, just Ansible. Because obviously I don't really do much otherwise in Linux world at work, so no, just Ansible.
There is a similar thing to the way that these tools work in the Windows world called
DSC, desired state configuration, which is what I've had a little play with in the past, but it's been a lot better in 2016. But a lot of the stuff I can do, I would do by group policy, which is more of the Ansible. Well, hang on, no, the other way around. So the Puppet kind of thing. So you would say
server based way of doing things.
Yeah, so basically the PC would, the server would go to the server. What can I have my policies? And it would then download the policies from the server and then apply them to them. So like making sure the files were there or the settings were configured this way. But DSCs is a very big and powerful thing, because what you can do, I don't know if you can do it in your the Linux world, is that you can get a server. Was like I was listening to a podcast the other day where it's SharePoint, so that you reverse DSC it. So you basically run, so it basically pulls all the config from it, and then you can then push it to somewhere else, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've never come across anything like that in the Linux world. It's not to say it can't be done. But yeah, it's not something that I've come across.
Because I was listening to a podcast and he said he was a SharePoint expert, and if you ever played with SharePoint, it's quite a nightmare. And he basically worked for Microsoft, and he'd get sent all around the world with problems. And he basically wrote a load of scripts so that he could get people to run them on the on the servers to get this DSC configuration so he could build it in his environment first, so he could go, so he would know what he was going into when he got to site.
One other thing that's worth mentioning is that, so Ansible, I think Puppet and Chef do as well, they can talk to the WinRM interface on Windows machines and configure. They've got kind of modules for configuring Windows machines. I think, certainly the Ansible one is written in PowerShell. Whereas if Ansible is talking to a Linux machine, it's doing it using Python. And I guess Puppet is using some kind of Ruby agent. With Windows, it'd be using PowerShell. Right? Certainly with Ansible, maybe with the others.
That may be something for me to have a look into the future about looking at how it goes into Windows and how I would use it.
As a non-Windows guy, I found it quite easy to configure Windows machines using Ansible. So likewise,
again, I've not stood up a lot of Windows machines, but the Windows machines I have stood up with, and so the Windows machines I have post-configured with Ansible have all been relatively stress-free to do. But likewise, I would also use GPO to push stuff out to Windows machine. Anyway, we're getting a little bit off track here. So the other thing that you can do quite nicely with Ansible, as well as post-provisioning servers, there's two things. You can stand up virtual machines, so you can ask hosting providers to provision your machines for you using Ansible. So we've mentioned in the past about working from Ansible to provision OpenStack and AWS and Azure, yeah. I think. So that's one thing. The other thing as well that you can do with Ansible is have it as a provisioner inside of Vagrant.
Yeah.
So when you, if you want to do your development work in a Vagrant machine, you can add a provisioning statement to your Vagrant file that provisions with Ansible your host. So it then means that you can then take the same Ansible files that you used on your Vagrant host and do the same thing on your AWS or Azure or OpenStack build.
Yeah, and it's also great for testing. So if you're just developing some Ansible code or any config management code, I guess, you can just have an automated system to stand up something in AWS or wherever, or DigitalOcean is my provider of choice. Run the code to make sure it works, and then kill the machine so it doesn't cost you any more money. And that is very easy to do using Vagrant.
So what I thought I would do is go through some of the terminology, just to kind of clarify what some of these words mean when we start using them in the conversation. So when you start using Ansible, you call the Ansible command with an instruction as to which host it is you're going to be working against. And that references a file called an inventory file. An inventory file is literally just a list of hosts and some information about the connections that they're going to make. So Ansible predominantly works over SSH. It used to use a Python library called Paramico, but it doesn't do that anymore. It just uses raw SSH connections now. And the SSH connections, you can specify a username and password. You can specify a username and the fact that you want to use sudo to escalate your privilege from being just a normal user to a super user account. You can also work with things like Docker. You can have a local host connection. I can't remember what the other connection types are that you've got, but those are the main three ones that you'll see. So once you've told Ansible what hosts it's going to be working with, you then tell Ansible which modules it's going to be using. Ansible ships with a lot of modules. And in fact, I'm going to add to the show notes the entry page to the list of modules for Ansible. And pretty much, once you find that modules page, 99.9% of what people want to do with Ansible is covered off in those modules. You might need to do a lot of wrangling to make it work, but generally, the modules are the building blocks of how Ansible fits together.
Yeah, so it'll generally be a module will do something, for instance, I mean, it's another topic, but templating a file, and then you have a load of parameters that you can pass to the module. Like, so if you've got a file, you can specify the owner of the file, the group of the file, the permissions on the file. So that's for instance, some of the parameters of the templating module. But you can have a lot more specific things like packaging modules. So APT, you can say, have a name of a package, whether it's there, whether it's present or whether it's absent, a specific version of it or the latest version, that kind of thing.
Another good one, if you're looking at kind of the real historics of Ansible, is you can work with like disk mounts, and you can specify everything that would be in an FS tab file from that. That's quite a useful thing to be able to do. So yeah, so taking this inventory and your modules, you start to build up playbooks. And a playbook is literally just a set of instructions that say, for this list of servers, I want you to apply these modules in this order with these arguments. So, you know, line one is show me a list of all of your configuration values for yourself. And then you might have, if this is a Red Hat based system, so Red Hat, CentOS, Fedora, you want to include this list of packages on the system. And if this is a Debian based system, you want to include this list of packages on the system. And then you might say, create these users with these usernames and these passwords. You might say things like, you know, create a file which has got this contents in it, or make sure that this particular line exists in this file. And to make your playbooks more flexible, you can use variables. So in your directory structure that you have your playbooks in, you would have either a file or a directory. So you'd have a directory called hostvars or groupvars, with the names of the groups that are in your inventory file to reference back to that terminology.
So the inventory would be like a list of hosts. So basically, it's most simple. It's a list of hosts, like host one, host two, host three. But then you can group those hosts into different groups. It's like an INI file. So you have a square brackets, and then you can say, you know, for instance, web, in your example of all your different services, you can have front end in square brackets, and then host one, host two, host three. And then, you know, database, host 4, host 5, host 6. And you can mix and match them as well between those groups. They don't have to be specifically in any one group. And then the host vars are variables that apply to specific hosts, and the group vars are variables that apply to specific groups. And you can have group vars all as well, so that's variables which apply globally.
So, yeah, so you've got these variable files. And so when I mentioned before about how if you wanted to say a Red Hat box must include these packages and a Debian-based box must include these packages, what you can do is you can have an instruction that says include certain variable files from your file system based on what the operating system is. So you might have a Windows file, and you might have a Red Hat file and a Debian file and an Arch file and whatever. And then use the packages modules to install the packages that particular variable file referenced. And talking of variables, you can change and filter the values that come from those variable files using the pipe or bar symbol, depending on how you learned your keyboard name, your keyboard character names. The one that looks like a line, and it's usually, oh, it's in all different places depending on the regions. But so you can have things like defaults. So if you said, you know, install package httpd
on CentOS.
On CentOS, for example. But if it's not defined from your variable file, so, you know, the httpd package, 90% of my builds are going to be done on a Red Hat box. So I'll do install, and you use a specific character, which is the curled braces. So you say bracket, bracket, and then the name of your variable. So you might say, you know, install package, web server, pipe, default, open bracket, quote, HTTPD, quote, close bracket, and then close your curled braces at the end. So it then says, you know, unless I override this value with another value, so if this value doesn't exist in any of my config files, use the name HTTPD. There's better ways of doing that, but that's one thing you can do.
So in this situation, for instance, on CentOS RHEL, you'd have your Apache package would be called HTTPD, but on Debian it'd be called Apache 2. So you have a variable there because to allow for that. So you can use the same code to install Apache on both flavors of Linux. And yeah, so that's the power of variables, really.
The other thing that's quite useful, all of these filters and things like this come from the fact that actually Ansible is using a templating language called Ginger, or Ginger 2 rather, which is not spelled G-I-N-G-E-R, but J-I-N-J-A-2. And that has this notion of filters. So Ginger has its own set of instructions that you can use. So you can do things like, you know, if then and else's, and you know, for loops and things like that. But you can also do these default values, or you can load other filters, like there's a filter that will do IP address filtering. So you can say, I want to look for any IP address that says 192.168.0.0/16. Anything that falls into that tree, that's an address I want to know about. And it will just build it from that.
One thing we haven't mentioned yet is what this format of the file is.
That is a good point. So all of these files so far,
except the host or the ini. Well, you can write it in it, but I think it's mainly done in ini file format.
Yeah. So the inventory file is typically in ini file format, just because usually you just want to have a list of files, a list of hosts. All the rest of these modules, all of the rest of these files so far are written in a config file format called YAML, which is short for YAML Ain't a Markup Language, because it used to be called Yet Another Markup Language. And then they realized it wasn't a markup language. So it's YAML Ain't a Markup Language. And essentially, it's just a plain text file using colons to separate a key from a value. But if you have a key and a colon, you can then have a nested array of data. So say, for example, you're having example colon space space name colon name one new line value colon value one. You can do things like that. Anyway, your best bet. So one of the things that we will indeed include in the show notes is a series of example files, or a list of examples that I've written. They're not necessarily the best examples in the world ever, but they're certainly a starting point to get you to have a look around kind of what there is out there.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of this is looping through lists of things to repeat something. So instead of doing the same step over and over again, either as a module or in a file, you can use looping to do that automatically.
Yeah, it was a bit confusing when I first looked at it until John explained to me with the hyphens. Is it hyphens in it? Yeah. And I was basically, to start off with, I was configuring it via a third party or a server with just Vim. But I've actually moved it back to my desktop machine now, and I'm using Atom, and it makes it nice color coded. And you can do the thing where you can like abbreviate it, so, or you can, well, where you can collapse the different tasks, which is quite good. And it color codes it as well. So now I understand about that, then it makes it really easy to understand.
Yeah.
So once you combined your modules into your playbooks and you've loaded these variables in, you can create files using templates, which is using this Ginger terminology. Your modules are assembled in your playbook as a series of tasks. One of the things that you can do with your tasks is you can say, if this task has resulted in a change to a file, notify another task. And that other task is referred to as a handler. So for example, if you had one of your tasks was to change the config file for Nginx, for example, you can then have a handler that restarts or reloads the config of Nginx, or, you know, if you make a change to your to a list of packages, you can say, okay, once this change of packages has been done, I want you to reload systemd, the systemd daemon, so it rereads all the config files and stuff like that.
Oh, I didn't know you could do that.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of sort of recursive reading, so you end up kind of clicking through things and going, okay, so when that happens, it's going to kick off that thing. Right, okay, that makes sense. The nice thing about that is you can have lots of instances in one file. So say, for example, you were injecting 12 different virtual hosts to a system, and then you wanted to go through and set the permissions on each one of those virtual hosts differently. And at the end of it, you then want to restart Nginx. Well, even if you only change one of them, at the end of it, you're going to want to restart Nginx. So you notify every time Nginx might need to be reloaded, but it only reloads the config once. So it waits until it does all the tasks, and then it runs all the handlers. Now, there are ways of forcing it to do it in a different order, but that's typically what you can do. So you've got your playbooks, your modules, your variables, your templates, and your handlers. What you then do is you combine those into a role. And not everyone does roles, and you don't have to do roles.
Yeah, because I don't think I've done roles yet. I think I've just literally done playbooks.
So essentially, if you're going to apply the same config to lots of different machines,
or even to use it more than once.
Yeah. So, for example, I was talking to Jerry before the show about a role that I've created that takes a password and tells you if it meets certain validation criteria. So I can include that as a role inside any of my playbooks and then call that role at any point in my playbook. And people have written roles and published those roles in a website called Ansible Galaxy. So it's galaxy.ansible.com. And there's literally thousands of roles in there. And, some people have anything from install Nginx to have config files the way I want them, install Nginx to have config files the way that I want them, and to serve as a reverse proxy or to serve as a key server or the server must consume Let's Encrypt. Or these are all lots of different ways of doing the same thing. But these people have all published these roles so that you don't have to write them yourself.
And they often take variables as input. So you have to supply, so as we were talking about, your host files or group files maybe, or just in a file, the variables need these roles to function. The roles need these variables to function properly a lot of the time, or they have the defaults set.
Mm. So that's the terminology in Ansible. One of the things that made Puppet and Chef appealing to people was that it had this kind of dashboard concept. So you could see how many hosts had had the config applied to it, how many hosts had passed on their runs, how many had failed on their runs. Ansible, as a company, was purchased a couple of years ago by Red Hat. And one of the products that Ansible was selling was a thing called Ansible Tower. Last year, Red Hat, as an open source company, open sourced the upstream for Ansible Tower, which is a product called AWX. So you can install AWX without paying for Ansible Tower and run what is functionally equivalent to Ansible Tower. Or if you want to purchase support from Red Hat, you can purchase Ansible Tower. And that gives you a pretty web interface. And that gives you webhooks, and that gives you all sorts of pretty graphs and diagrams and permission controls that you can assign to specific members of your staff. But that's not something that you have to know about to run Ansible. It's just if you want to show to management that this Ansible thing is the best thing since sliced bread and they want to see a breakdown of every host that's ever been touched, Ansible Tower gives you that. In a way that doesn't mean you're sort of reading through shell scripts for the rest of forever.
It sounds like you're speaking from experience there, John.
I can neither confirm nor deny that statement.
Okay. NDAs and all that.
I couldn't possibly comment. So that's kind of a rundown of what Ansible is to me. Is there anything in there that you think I've missed, Jerry or Al?
Not really, no. I mean, no, it's a good overview, I think.
Yeah, until you start actually using it, when I've heard you talk about it in the past, until you start talking about it and actually, well, for me to get my head around it, I have to start using it. I mean, it's like that vagrant thing. I think I've gone and I've got my head around what you guys are talking about it, but until I have a little play with it myself.
Yeah. Believe me, I've had a few run-ins with Vagrant recently myself. So once you get past the sort of simple usage cases, then it all gets a bit more complicated.
Because if I give you some examples, what like I'm doing to deploy my template or my VPS server, I'm basically going to DigitalOcean every time to spin up a box and then play my playbooks on it and then destroying it. I'm guessing I could maybe use Vagrant to do the first bit for me.
What you do is you write your Ansible code and you put a Vagrant file next to your Ansible code, like in the same directory. And then once you've done that, you can just say Vagrant up. And you have to do, I think you have to do a bit of configuration with Vagrant to be able to do that. But then you can just say Vagrant up and it'll run your Ansible code automatically and with any variables and so on. And then you've got your server there and you can log into it and it's got you do just basically Vagrant SSH as like a subcommand to log into your server, have a look around, see that it's doing what you think it's doing or what it's supposed to do.
So interestingly, so I mentioned that I wrote a series of example files sort of showing how you'd do these sorts of things. And the last one of those is actually with a Vagrant file and a Ansible playbook
right.
in the same directory. Literally, all that it does is it just shows a debug message in there, but you can see how that is. So the five examples that I wrote are all in a GitHub repository. So you don't need to know how to use Git. You just need to know how to click around the directory structure. But so the first example that I wrote was literally just using Ansible as an executable to check all the hosts that you've got are still responding to Ansible. Second one was to deploy software to a single machine. The third one is to update a config file. So it creates a config file and updates it using three separate modules, and then restarts the services using handlers based on the config files having been changed. I go into tags and roles in example four. And then, as I said, example five is using Ansible in Vagrant. So those are going to be in the show notes for people to go and have a look at and see if they sort of make your life easier or less easy.
Yeah, we should probably cover tags just quickly. They are literally what they say there. You can add a tag to any task, I think, and then...
Oh, it's more than that.
Or role, yeah, or whatever, yeah. And then just when you do your Ansible run, you can put -T for tag, and then it will only run those specific things when you do that Ansible run.
So there's another thing you can do with tags as well, which I never really thought about until one of my colleagues showed it to me, which is there's another flag, which is skip tags. My common use case for Ansible at work is provisioning hosts into OpenStack. And typically, if I've stood up all the networking side of things, so, and this is all OpenStack terminology, so router, you connect your public network to your router and an internal network to your router, you create a security group, you create an internal subnet, and you ensure your SSH keys on the service. Those five steps, you don't need to do those every time. You just need to do them the first time. So I have a skip tag for skipping the networking steps because I know that I've already done them and that part takes 2 minutes to run when actually what I want to do is run the maybe 10 minutes of bits afterwards. But if I'm saving 2 minutes from that, I can save 2 minutes from that. So typically my site.yaml, so a lot of people will define, have a standard naming convention for the for the playbook they want to run all the rest of the stuff. And that site.yaml has tags for all of the includes that it does. So you can include other playbooks into your main playbook. Yeah. And so I'll add tags to those includes to say, this is the networking bit. This is the security group bit. This is the SSH key bit. This is the whatever bit. And then I have in the same one, exclude these bits so that I can say I want to run all of the stuff to do with networking, but not the bit about security groups, for example.
Right.
Makes it very flexible, but it does mean your initial playbook looks really complicated. So example four does sort of quite easily, quite clearly show that tags system. And so each of the examples I wrote includes a shell script for how you might call that playbook, showing off the various features. So that's kind of my experience of Ansible and Ansible with Vagrant and Ansible with cloud providers.
So I basically as well put in that Git repository as well my current flavor of the Yam or the playbooks I have been using, just kind of show you how I've kind of been using it. So what it does. Yeah, so basically one is that when you basically boot up a DigitalOcean droplet, you can tell DigitalOcean to what SSH key to use, but by default it uses the root user. So I basically did it so that it logs in as that root and then adds in a couple of users, copies their public SSH keys over and adds to the sudo group, and then disables root login and password login to the SSHD and then restarts that service. And then I've got another one which basically is the deploying the Nginx, MySQL and PHP, which basically then updates it to the latest versions and sets MySQL password and then copies a load of files across. So the php.ini file across, which is configured. So my next kind of, which I hopefully should have on by the end of when we get this released, is that is obviously creating the server blocks for the Nginx, which hopefully I'm going to be using that Ginger thing you were talking about.
Yeah.
And
templates.
The templates, yeah. And obviously doing this thing where it's like it, so I can basically, if I need to add a new user in, I can just run that. It'll basically create all the folders I need and the permissions and the Nginx server block. I mean, coming from from my way of not actually ever using it before and just using it, installing it, I had it. So I'll just go through a couple of issues I had so that people don't go across the same issues. What I had, one was installing it. I first installed it using pip, the Python, and that didn't, and I was very confused because it didn't create the required files that need an etc folder. By default, you have to create them manually. So I used Jerry's idea of using the PPA part, and that basically created the required folders in the etc folder for you.
That's interesting. I only ever use the pip version. But that's because I'm running against lots of different hosts at once. I'm doing different things with needing to access different hosts. So I don't have a common inventory file. I don't have a common playbook that is done against everyone. I have a playbook and an inventory file in the directory, and I have a script that runs to trigger that playbook talking to that inventory file.
I've gone over to that way because I used to have everything in a big inventory file, but it gets really confusing really quickly. So I've gone over to like a project kind of way of working. So I just have, like, if I have a client, I'll have a folder for them, a directory for them, sorry, and then some roles underneath there, and maybe different inventory files depending what machines I'm talking to under that directory. So it just helps keep everything a bit more compartmentalized, and then have a I'll generally have a roles directory that's shared, or a roles directory somewhere else, and then you point to that roles directory from the different sort of project directories.
Yeah, because the video I was watching on YouTube, they were copying the files from the etc folder into your home directory, and then you had to modify the ansible.cfg file.
So if you're working with the sort of project thing that I've just described, I generally have an ansible.cfg in each directory, and often they're the same. They're just, a lot of the time, they're just pointing to the roles directory. The ansible.cfg, you can basically set any sort of standard parameter there for the way Ansible works, just to explain that a bit more. So yeah, I'll generally have a cfg per project and do it that way.
The other couple of things I want to just mention that help is I had an issue with Python, not on the actual where you're running the script from, but the actual server you were speaking to. DigitalOcean template, which you deployed, hasn't got Python 2 installed by default. It's got Python 3.
Right.
And the error message I was getting, I Googled it, and it was saying you need to put this option in your host file to say that use where the Python 3 was. That worked fine, but when I got to doing some more complicated stuff, it kept erroring out, and it really confused me. But what was happening was, because a new version of Ansible can have the option to use Python 3, but because not all of the functionality yet has been reconfigured to Python 3. And I think it was John who's recommended this edit, that one of my first tasks I run in my playbook is to install Python 2, but you kind of got into a chicken and egg situation, because I was trying to install Python using using Ansible, but obviously it's looking for Ansible. Sorry, looking for Python, but John gave me a script which basically didn't use, kind of seemed to be using some sort of raw technology or raw command.
Yeah. That just runs a basic SSH command, rather than, because to use Ansible on a target machine, you need Python in Python 2 in the old days installed and on that machine. So if you need to install Python, then you can use raw to do that.
So that threw me for a bit. And then once I've got Python 2 and all my other scripts, I think it's when I was trying to set the password on the MySQL, it was asking for something in pip, but it was looking for pip 3 and not pip 2. So,
right.
And the other thing is that working out is that if you create users by Ansible, in the password field, it isn't what you put in it as plain text. You have to SHA-5 it to basically basically puts it in the SHA-5 format, so it can put it directly into the correct, I can't remember what the file is now.
So that's an interesting one. So the reason why that is because really you shouldn't be storing plain text passwords in a config file. And by forcing you to hash that value, you're not storing a plain text value in your tree, in theory, at any point. But that doesn't always work.
Because I had basically done something where I didn't want to have those passwords stored in those configs. I had a variable file, which I then protected with I can't remember what it's called now, but...
Ansible Vault?
Yes, to protect it.
So those are definitely things you can do. You hash it and you... you try not to have, so Ansible Vault literally just is a single string encryption of your variable files. So you'd use that. So you can use that to commit that to into your Git repository or something like that if you wanted to.
It's another sort of example of using variables as well. So storing secrets as variables, because you can take those secrets and you don't have to have them in your general Ansible code. I've recently been using pass, the sort of command line tool for storing passwords, which you can use GPG as a back end. So you can call that. So you can basically grab an encrypted value from your pass store and pass it to Ansible, which will do the necessary stuff with it and put it where it's supposed to be.
So I think we've gone pretty long, in all honesty, on Ansible now. As Al mentioned, he's put his examples that he's written into a Git repository, which we're going to link to from the show notes. I also have put some stuff into there as well.
I have yet to at time of recording, but I should get some up there by the time it's released.
But likewise, I put a lot of stuff that I'm working on a day-to-day basis into my Git repositories, so into my GitHub profile. So if there's anything that you want to have a poke around in, certainly in my trees, please feel free to have a look. And if you've got any questions, please don't hesitate to contact into the show and say, I was looking at this thing and it didn't make any sense. Where was that? Or, you know, contact us directly, you know, whichever makes more sense to you.
And maybe we'll put up some stuff that's confusing us that we don't know how to do that you guys might.
Well, yes, there is that. We always have some things that we like to mention on the show. So we have three upcoming events. On the 9th of June in King's Cross, London, there's FossTalk Live, and you can find more information about FossTalk Live at fosstalk.com. That's Foxtrot Oscar Sierra Sierra Tango Alpha Lima Kilo, fosstalk.com. We also have the Glasgow Pod Crawl on Saturday, the 28th of July, and there's details at the link. For information about that will be on the show notes because the URL is too long to read, unfortunately. And there is also OggCamp on the 18th and 19th of August. That will be in Sheffield. And for more information on that, go to OggCamp. That's Oscar Golf Golf Charlie Alpha Mike Papa, OGGCAMP.org. I'm one of the organisers of that. So again, it'd be great to see some of the listeners at that event. Is there anything else that you guys want to mention?
I don't know if I mentioned it last show, but I've started a tech blog, which I am trying to keep updated. I think we can put the URL in the show notes, but it's this blogging platform called, it's like a subtle, but it's spelled S-V-B-T-L-E. So Sierra, Victor, Bravo, Tango, Lima, Echo. .com. So tiktokhouse.subtle.com. And I've got a few posts there just detailing things, problems, how I solve problems and so on. It doesn't actually allow comments, which might be a good or a bad thing. But if anyone's got any thoughts on that, just mail into the show or get in touch with us on Telegram channel or whatever. And I can try and clarify or whatever.
The one thing I'd like to mention is a thing called bullet journaling. It's, you know, we always talk about keeping lists and what your kind of to-do lists. I was listening to a podcast the other day. It's basically using actually pen and paper, but it's a way of keeping track of tasks. I'll put a link in the show notes to the YouTube video what completely explains it, but I'm going to start trying to use it and I will come back on the next episode of how well it's been going.
I think Fab was talking about that. Fabian Sheshall from X Linux Outlaws and so on.
All right, that wasn't the podcast that I was listening to. It was one called Cool Tools, which is a really cool podcast. It's released weekly. It's basically, they get people on every week and they basically just tell them what their tools are like, as in like if they find a new tool. They have guests on every week and it's quite interesting.
Well, if you're plugging podcasts, I'll plug another one. So I've been listening to a podcast called The Hackable Podcast. And in that, each episode, the presenter reviews a sequence from a film in which something is hacked or something is misappropriated to do something else. So, for example, one of the recent scenes was that he used was from Mr. Robot, where the guy caught the key fob press of a woman to steal her car. And that's at hackablepodcast.com. And so basically they take that thread from a common scene in a film or TV program and just confirm or deny whether or not it actually can happen and whether it would happen.
Mr. Robot is generally pretty good at that. It's quite realistic in that sense.
I mean, that's one example of many. They cited the opening sequence of a Chucky film in one of them, which was a bit weird. So
on that note as well, there's on the Computer Filed YouTube channel, there's a recent video, Computers in Film and TV, which is quite interesting. It's at the Museum of at the Centre for Computing History. I don't know where that is.
I think that's at Bletchley Park, isn't it?
Is it? Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
But there's a guy there talking about various things. He basically consults for movies and TV series and so on, and supplies equipment to appear in those sorts of things. So that's quite interesting. It's only like 10 minute long video. It's quite interesting. And if I may recommend another podcast I've been getting into, because I've got a longer commute, I've been getting into some fiction podcasts, and I've actually already listened to this series, but it's called Within the Wires. It's from the people that brought you Welcome to Night Vale, if anyone's heard of that. And if it's well worth a listen. I've been really enjoying it. I listened to it week by week before, and it kind of, you know, it was a little sort of different from my other podcasts, and I've just basically binged the whole of the first season, and I'm about to do the same for the second season. It's called Within the Wires, and it's really good. I recommend it.
Oh, sounds really good.
I'll put a link in the show notes for that.
Just go back. We were talking at the Centre of Computer History.
Yeah.
That's in Cambridge.
Is it? Okay.
My apologies.
Because there's one of the guys I work with kind of volunteers for that, and he's got a website called Binary Dinosaurs, and he likes doing literally retro computers. I'm not talking like Spectrums and stuff. I'm talking about stuff before that. And yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes. But I'd like to get him on, because he's very old school with his Linux and Unix stuff. Because basically we had a problem the other day with a kernel panic on a physical server, and he was showing me the crash command and how he was trying to find out what module. It was basically a memory module had gone faulty, and he was showing me in the crash command. I was just going, whoa. Right over my head kind of thing.
Well then, so I think we're getting to the end of this show. So if you've been listening to this and have been screaming, saying, oh no, you've missed all the stuff that I wanted you to talk about.
What John used to do.
Yes, or if there's something that you want us to, you'd like us to do more of, please email feedback@admin.co.uk. And if you want to find any of the other ways to interact with us, which includes our Facebook channel, Facebook page rather, our Telegram group, our Twitter feed, or subscribe to our Patreon feed, then the details for all of those are on our website, which is at admin.co.uk. And so with that, I think we've come to the end of another show, guys. So thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yep. Thanks for listening.
And until next time, speak to you soon.
Bye for now.
Bye. Now we're